they sat here?
In Jesus' name.
He just shot his arm off. We got pulled over on Larpiner.
I told him not to reach for it. I told him to get his hand out.
Mommy, brother, if you need a hand, we all need somebody to lean.
What do we want?
Justice.
What do we want?
Now.
What do we want?
Justice.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry today. 72 hours of violence in America. The killing of two African-American men by police, one in Minnesota and one in Louisiana. The protests of those killings and others unraveled by sniper fire in Dallas as police officers are gunned down. The already impossibly complex national conversation about police and guns and race is now even more convoluted. The Dallas Police Department does not have a reputation for the use of excessive force or police brutality. In fact, it has become something of a national role model for community policing. All this hour, we examine what it means to be a cop having to keep the peace in a nation where over 300 million guns are out in public. Also, what it means to be armed and African American. And Michael Eric Dyson on This Moment and what white America has failed to see over the last few days. You are part of this conversation with us on guns and police. Race and violence.
We can either see this as the beginning of war, or we can see this as the beginning of healing, and I hope it will be the beginning of healing.
I'm scared that their lives aren't in danger, and I just wish there was something that I could do, but I know that there's nothing I can do.
We want to hear from you. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can comment on our Facebook page at facebook.com/thetakeaway. Also, at the website at thetakeaway.org. Dallas Police Chief David O'Neill Brown said the motivations of the shooter, named Micah Xavier Johnson, age 25, were clear.
The suspect said he was upset about Black Lives Matter. He said he was upset about the recent police shootings. The suspect said he was upset at white people. The suspect stated he wanted to kill white people, especially white officers. The suspect stated we will eventually find the IEDs. The suspect stated he was not affiliated with any groups, and he stated that he did this alone.
So part of the problem Americans have to unravel is how police patrol a nation where guns are legal and part of the culture, and where the Americans they stop or pull over own 300 million firearms. It also raises the question for many Americans, primarily people of color, of how they stay safe, even when exercising their right to own a gun. Nick Selby is a detective in the Dallas area in Texas. He's also author of the book In Context, Understanding Police Killings of Unarmed Civilians. Nick Selby, your thoughts now on the officers killed in Dallas.
It was obviously shocking and obviously very, very sad for the families of the officers who were killed last night. I have to say, filled with pride watching the Dallas Police Department handle this situation so professionally, watching those officers run towards the danger, handling the situation, and most of all being as transparent and open as they were throughout the night, giving out information, which is really exactly what we need our police to be doing, giving out more data earlier, and that's exactly what the Dallas Police Department did today.
One of the real difficulties as the country tries to digest all this, it seems to me, is that there's this difficult conversation about police and civilians. There's a difficult conversation about race and about guns that we've been having all these many months and years. And now it's a conversation inevitably that's also about the killing of cops. And that's way more complicated.
I think it is. And I think that the dynamic that we have right now in the country is unfortunately one of there's a lot of mistrust. And I think that a lot of people are speaking past one another. I think that both law enforcement officers, law enforcement administrators, government officials, activists, and just citizens are taking refuge in a position and speaking their position, but not actually hearing the other. And I think that to get past this, we're going to have to start having some fundamental trust that both sides want to make things better and listening more to one another.
Nick Selby, one of the issues that we did want to talk to you about is how police operate in a country that is awash with guns. The reality is that police are going to confront suspects all the time with guns in this country, both legal and illegal, because there are 300 million guns in America. We saw the case especially of Philando Castile in Minnesota, who, according to his fiancée, had a legal weapon with a permit and told the officer. It raises the question of how police approach people when they know they have a gun and deal with that situation. What can you say about those many, many times that must happen?
Yeah, and without speculating on that, because we actually don't have the video, I'll tell you what I do, and I think it's instructive. Whenever I get pulled over, I will turn the engine off. I'll roll down my windows. If it's at night, I turn on my dome light, and I put my hands on the top of the steering wheel. The reason I do this is I want the officer to see that I'm making an effort to make him feel safe, and it also removes the need for me to move my hand quickly or reach something to get something. It's all right there. So if you are at that point carrying a concealed weapon, or if you have a gun in the car, you know, those of us who carry concealed, we've already made a lot of adjustments in our lifestyle. We buy special clothes, we buy special holsters. This should not be any different. Keep your driver's license, your weapon permit, your registration, keep it all in the same place as far from that gun as possible. And then as the officer approaches and he tells you why you've been stopped, hand him your papers. And then once you have the papers in his hands, you say, "Officer, please be advised for your safety. I'm a concealed weapon permit holder. I do have a handgun in the car. It's located in a holster on my right hip. What would you like me to do?" And when you do that, you've given him the control. Sometimes they'll actually tell you to get out of the car. They might want to disarm you. A lot of times they'll give you sort of the equivalent of, "Hey, don't show me yours and I won't show you mine."
I want to play you a piece of sound from a journalist at The Washington Post who was on the show yesterday. We were talking about how The Washington Post has tracked the 509 Americans killed by police so far this year. For a little bit of context, this is Stephen Rich of The Washington Post.
The numbers really haven't changed on a lot of fronts. The majority of victims are still white people, but black people are killed at a rate of about 2.5 times that of white people.
A rate of about 2.5 times of white people. That's the Washington Post data, Nick Selby. And that raises the question of this conversation that you and I are having about what to do when a police officer approaches and you have a gun. I think a lot of African-American people hear this conversation and say, that does not always work for us.
Sure. And the strategy I just mentioned is I would believe, and my colleagues would believe, is the absolute safest strategy. I do want to point out that the Washington Post, while in those numbers, what the Washington Post itself found last year was that fully 90% of the people who were shot by police and killed by police were in the process of a deadly attack at the time that they were shot. This is not just sort of arbitrary killings. And the 2.5 times is really a population-controlled number that is disputed by a lot of academics. I will not say that the fear or trepidation that African-American drivers have is unreal. I believe that that's very real. But in terms of crunching those statistics, I think that the more important thing is when you as a driver, whether you are white, black, Hispanic, doesn't matter, when you as a driver go out of your way to slow things down and give the officer the control of the situation, they will almost always respond in kind, and they will respond reasonably.
There is some reason to believe, however, and I go back to Philando Castile in Minnesota, that he did inform that police officer, maybe not in such a procedural way that you're describing, Detective Selby, but he did a lot of things right and still wound up with a deadly gunshot wound.
I literally cannot argue that, because I just don't know what happened in that case. And I think that, you know, what we have on that case is it's an interesting case of dueling narratives on the same video. We're going to have to watch and see how that plays out.
Let's talk about the person that maybe you're not as confident about, however, somebody who has a gun in their pocket. How dangerous is that gun if it doesn't come out? If that person says, "I've got a gun," or if you see part of a gun or you suspect they have one in their pocket, but they haven't brandished it.
That's a terrific question. It's actually at the crux of it all, right? In our book, we talked about killings by police of unarmed civilians, and many people believe that because a civilian is unarmed, it means that he's not dangerous. We had two people who were unarmed who actually had already murdered someone by the time the police arrived last year. And similarly, you know, when I'm going to the store and I have a gun that's in my holster and I'm squeezing the tomatoes, I might be armed, but I'm certainly not dangerous. It really does come down to the context of the situation. If someone has an illegal gun even, and they're not reaching for it, they're not doing anything particularly with it, that's not something that gives me an immediate concern. Where I start to get concerned is where people start to give us combat indicators, they start to give us indicators that they're getting angry, they're ready to start using physical force or deadly force. That's when the danger level really comes up, and that's, I think, something that officers are generally very, very good at detecting, and generally good at detecting it correctly.
Nick Selby is a detective in the Dallas area in Texas. He is author of In Context, Understanding Police Killings of Unarmed Civilians. Detective Selby, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Well, in this complex debate about the safety of police and the safety of citizens, one key question is, how should police departments be reformed? We've been asking you.
I believe that any officer-involved shooting across the country, those officers should be put on unpaid leave until an investigation clears them. And if they are not clear, they should be prosecuted themselves. They are here to protect Americans, and instead they're executing us. I'm saying this as someone who has several family members that are not only cops, but also sheriffs. And I know that there are a lot of good cops out there, but unfortunately, this is just a problem that is so out of control. It's more than just one or two or four bad apples.
We got this from Portland. I think residency requirements are worth consideration. Police officers should live in the communities they serve.
Hi, this is Mark from Seattle, Washington. It's been my observation that police departments have evolved into paramilitary forces since the 1990s. And unless we want to have more incidences of violence towards citizens, we need to get them back into the law enforcement type of endeavor rather than a paramilitary force. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Elise. I'm calling from Detroit, Michigan. I absolutely would give law enforcement a makeover, look at other countries where police violence is not as heavily present, and model social programs around that. I also think that diversification among police officers and law enforcement staff would really deepen their sense of empathy.
Alejandro Lilienthal happened to be a rabbi. A long time ago, I lived in Brazil. And my comment is, with all these tragedies occurring in our country now, I always remember that in Brazil, this became routine. So another person gets shot and another policeman gets shot, and it is like, you know, it's almost as routine as carnival and soccer, and that cannot happen. That cannot happen in the United States.
We want you to join this complex conversation about the police and about the citizens they serve. Call us 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can always follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, working to help people reclaim between 5 and 30 minutes a day to learn something new and build their CQ or Curious Quotient through the game of lifelong learning. More at Curious.com/PRI.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick with you today. As we heard a moment ago with Dallas area Detective Nick Selby, the nation was already struggling with the ongoing debate about police, race, and guns, and that struggle just got harder. The families of Alton Sterling in Baton Rouge and Philando Castile in Minnesota lost loved ones in the last 72 hours, and so did the families of five Dallas police officers protecting a protest about those very killings. The debate about police killing civilians is now inevitably intertwined with the reality of someone killing police. Professor Carol Anderson says that debate also can't escape another reality, and that is, while all Americans have a right to carry guns, for African Americans and other people of color, that right is just not the same when it comes to being stopped by police. Carol Anderson is professor of African American Studies at Emory University. She's also author of White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. Professor Anderson, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you so much for having me.
There were protests in Dallas last night that were protesting the killing of two different African-American men, one in Minnesota, of course, and one in Baton Rouge, which then resulted in the deaths of five police officers and the wounding of seven more. What are you seeing in this moment right now?
I'm seeing the United States at a critical moment in its history, at a crossroads, where the nation is having to decide what its core value is. When I'm seeing the killing in Minnesota, as well as the video of the killing in Baton Rouge, you know, you see this kind of sense that led to Black Lives Matter. The shooting in Dallas, the sniper fire that killed 5 police officers and wounded 6 others. There you see, I mean, you had a protest against the killings in Minnesota and in Louisiana, and it was a peaceful protest. And you had the police officers actually protecting the protesters. I mean, so that tells you about what we're striving to be about. And then you have those who resort to violence, to sniper fire, and who apparently had weaponry that was in some cases better than what the police officers themselves had. And I think that that also is speaking to another issue that is coursing through American society, which deals with the issues of ready access to almost military grade weaponry.
And that's an issue that I want to talk to you about. Before we get there, you know, there is a danger, it seems to me, of having to connect these series of events now, Baton Rouge in Minnesota, the shootings of Black men at the hands of police, with the organized killing of 5 police officers and the wounding of 7 more. We're now at a point where this is all one conversation, Carol Anderson. Black men get killed, but oh, cops get killed too. And it seems to me that this is a very risky and unhealthy way to have to talk about this.
I believe so, absolutely. And you saw some jumping to judgment. So there was one of the New York dailies runs a headline that says Civil War with the picture of Dallas downtown. This isn't a civil war. And to cast it as such without having details really begins to fuel the kind of angst and anger and vitriol that is at the subtext of a lot of a wing of American society. You had a former congressman issue a tweet that was just absolutely inappropriate and horrific about the killings in Dallas, and so then it was Obama, you're coming after you, and Black Lives Matter, you're next. I mean, really, this kind of resort to violence and this kind of sense of trying to connect Black Lives Matter, which has been about valuing life, with the systematic killing in Dallas of police officers is wrong. Just wrong.
We just heard from Detective Nick Selby, who gave, from the police officer's perspective, some instructions about if you're carrying a gun, how to stay safe with a cop. And I wonder what you think about how African Americans view those instructions. You know, hands on the wheel, tell the cop you have a gun. It seems that that doesn't always work.
It doesn't work. You know, so you had the case, for instance, you know, in Minnesota, where he said, "Sir, I have a weapon," because the police officer had asked for his license. And so he's doing the instructions, what you're instructed to do. I'm letting the police officer know I'm reaching for my license, which is what the police officer asked me to do. I want him to know that I have a gun, but I have a concealed permit to carry this gun. And that didn't save him. That didn't save Mr. Castillo. And so what happens here is that we're dealing with more than, you know, just follow the rules, follow the simple set of instructions. We're also dealing with a default system in the judicial system in American society that sees Black as threat, that sees this warning danger sign. And so all of the signals that should not be going off are going off. And we don't see that same kind of policing, and I just say Dylan Roof, the young white man last year who killed 9 people
in
South Carolina. When they found him, so this is a man that you know kills people. When they found him, they took him in alive, and before they took him in, he said he was hungry, so they took him to Burger King so he could get some food. that tells me that there is such a massive difference in the way that black people and whites are treated in American society, viewed as a threat.
Carol Anderson is professor of African American Studies at Emory University. She is author of White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. Professor Anderson, thanks for being on The Takeaway.
Thank you so much.
We go to Dallas now, where relations between police and citizens are going to be tested after the killing of five police officers and the wounding of seven more at a protest about police violence last night. One suspect, 25-year-old Micah Xavier Johnson, told police he was upset about Black Lives Matter and wanted to, quote, kill white people, white officers in particular. Johnson himself was killed with the use of a police bomb robot armed with explosives. City Councilwoman Tiffany A. Young is a Texas native. She represents the 7th District in Dallas, Texas. Councilwoman Young, welcome.
Thank you.
Can you assess the mood of your community and your constituents after the horrific events last night?
We have heavy hearts here in the city of Dallas right now as we mourn the loss of life with some of our police officers. But then in particular, as the representative for District 7 in the city of Dallas, it is a community where in the past we have seen some officer-involved shootings. And so... it is a community that is dealing with a lot right now, and it is a situation that we are truly really going to have to be thoughtful as we move forward in understanding both ends of the spectrum. And we understand that we can still be supportive of our police while we also send the message that just as in any profession, that we want to make sure that everyone is functioning and treating our citizens with dignity and respect. And so the community is in a state of shock. The community is hurting right now for a number of reasons. And I think the emotions, it just run the full gamut.
Were there members of your community in your district who were out at the protest last night?
Yes, there are members of the district. And the district that I represent actually stretches from far south in Dallas down to what we call South Dallas proper, which actually connects to downtown. And so my district is very close to where this incident took place. So there are members of the district that were there. Let me just make sure I reiterate what was a very peaceful protest.
Councilwoman Tiffany A. Young, how would you characterize overall, if you can, the overall relationship between members of the Dallas Police Department and constituents where you live?
Our police chief has really worked hard in terms of community policing. We have an event coming up that was already scheduled that they started last year called Let's Talk, where they are reaching out to our high school students to try to better engage them and form those relationships with young people and the police officers and really engaging them with police officers and then even with the foot patrol and getting our officers out in the community and neighborhood police officers. And so even in the midst of that, you still have members of the community who quite honestly are distrustful. And that is something that we will continue to work on here in Dallas in terms of building that trust. We know that trust is something that it takes a long time to build and can be ruined in a number of seconds. And so we will continue, and as the council member for District 7, I will do everything in my power to continue to help bridge that gap and continue to make sure that we are building positive relationships with the community and the police.
And it seems like there is a real risk now, not only in Dallas, but in other communities. The conversation this country has been having for a couple of years over the dangers of confrontations between police and African Americans in particular, but other people of color, now mixed with that conversation about, well, police get killed too.
It is a conversation that we certainly have to carefully construct how we find that balance and how we have that conversation. Certainly, we would be hopeful that in days to come that we would be able to come together as a community. And that is just what we're calling for. Come together. We want to come together not only in Dallas, but in communities across this country. I have friends that are elected in Baton Rouge and there in St. Paul, Minnesota area. That's just the conversation that we are talking about, and what types of policies we need to be looking at as policymakers, and how we can be intentional in what we're doing as leaders in our communities, and what the message we need to carry back into our communities as to how we can come together.
Tiffany A. Young represents the 7th District in Dallas, Texas. Councilwoman Young, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
And we want to go now to Minnesota, where Philando Castile was shot and killed by a police officer. And community tensions have been high in the St. Paul suburb of Falcon Heights. Tim Nelson is reporter with Minnesota Public Radio. Tim Nelson, welcome.
Hi.
Of course, the shooting of Philando Castile and his death are part of the ongoing string of protests and aftermath, including the killings in Dallas that we just heard about from KERA. What's the latest from where you are in Falcon Heights in Minneapolis?
Well, as you know, this started July 6th with a shooting of a black motorist in Falcon Heights by an officer from a neighboring suburb. The investigation has begun. But, you know, the real key to this was that Facebook video. The girlfriend of the man who was shot streamed the aftermath live on Facebook Live. That brought out hundreds of protesters within hours of that incident. There were protesters lining the street across from the scene of the shooting as they were investigating it, as they were still marking where people had stood, measuring the position of the car. Within moments of that wrapping up, protesters marched down to the governor's mansion here in St. Paul, which is only a few miles away, and they've been camped out there since. It started out with a small group. It's now developed into quite a gathering there. They have shelter, boxes of food, large quantities of bottled water. And then another rally started yesterday at the public school where the man who was shot was a lunchroom supervisor. And that developed into a march that went through St. Paul. It continued through the night. There was some sporadic violence there last night. Police car was damaged. The window of a jewelry shop was damaged, and there was one arrest. We haven't heard of any serious injuries, though.
Tim Nelson, there has to be a concern among the protesters in St. Paul and around Minnesota in the suburb of Falcon Heights now, given the horrific violence in Dallas at a similar protest in many ways, where police officers died and were wounded. There could be a move towards additional violence now as people look towards Dallas. There has to be a concern in Minnesota.
Well, and you should remember that in the wake of a shooting in November here in Minneapolis, some gunmen approached a protest outside a Minneapolis police station and opened fire on the protesters there. This is not something that hasn't happened before here, this kind of violence surrounding these protests of various motivations. So that has been a concern here for some time as these issues have played out here in the Twin Cities.
So what does the police presence around those protests look like now as the security dimension, which was already tense, takes on a whole new level here?
It's pretty substantial. There is a 3-block stretch of Summit Avenue that has been closed overnight in front of the governor's mansion. There are police squads stationed on the street and on the cross streets, and you can tell those officers are keeping an eye on people that are coming and going as this develops. There isn't a substantial presence, or there hasn't been a substantial presence of protesters in front of the governor's mansion this morning. There were only about 20, most of them dispersed overnight. But, you know, we've seen that before with these protests. They ebb and flow as news develops and facts come out about these cases. So we'll be watching that all day today.
You mentioned the governor's mansion, and one thing that was remarkable from Minnesota Governor Mark Dayton was the strength of the statement that he made after Philando Castile's killing. He essentially said that Philando Castile would be alive after that police stop if he were white.
That's right. He has used some of the strongest language of his two terms here to talk about this incident. He's been very cautious and very circumspect about previous shootings, and he has really come out four square on this matter.
And it was remarkably strong. Did Governor Mark Dayton face did he face criticism after being too soft before?
No, but he is facing some criticism now. There are some police supporters who say that they are warning that he may be prejudging this situation. So both sides of this situation are speaking out about this as this develops here in the Twin Cities.
Tim Nelson with Minnesota Public Radio in Minneapolis and the suburbs of Falcon Heights after the killing of Philando Castile. Tim Nelson, thank you.
You're welcome.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. This is Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry today as we and the rest of the country digest this complex and tragic set of events of the last 72 hours. The killing of two black men, one in Minnesota, one in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. The protests of those events in Dallas marred, horribly marred by the apparently organized killing of five police officers, seven more wounded. Both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, who are campaigning for president, have both canceled their campaign events for today. Just one example of the impact that all of this horrible tragedy is having on the country and on the national conversation, which has become increasingly now convoluted and complex. Michael Eric Dyson is with me now. He's an academic, best-selling author, and professor of sociology at Georgetown University. His latest book, The Black Presidency, Barack Obama, and the Politics of Race in America. Michael Eric Dyson, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
And thanks for being here. The events of the last 72 hours that I just described, how are you viewing this moment right now?
Well, this is America in a nutshell. We have extraordinarily competing visions of who we are as a nation. We have unfocused anger and rage against the problems that confront us. And we need political figures to clarify and not muddy the waters. So on the one hand, we have black people who have a righteous outrage against being targeted viciously by certain police people who seem not to be able to distinguish the fact of our being black from the fact that we may be likely to be suspicious, or that the kind of panic that is associated with us leads often to our deaths, even when we do the thing that police ask us to do. Hands up, let me tell you what I'm doing, I'm very calm, and still get shot. So there's a righteous indignation about what happens on that side. On the other hand, we don't want any police person to be targeted for being a police person, to be a victim of the kind of hatred and lone wolf terror that this police department in Dallas was subject to as well. And we need the police to not feel that, see, this is what we tell you. We are being subject to this every day, because black people have a legitimate claim and right, as with brown people and others, to say we want the police department to protect us, to help us, not to terrorize us, not to viciously and calculatedly target us with its venom. And at the same time, they have the right as police people not to be, to expect not to be viciously calculatedly targeted by forces that want to undermine them. The only way forward is to acknowledge the hostilities, the conflicts, the hurt and pain, and figure out a way to both acknowledge the right of citizens to be protected and served by police departments, and for those police departments to be able to carry out their duties without being viciously targeted by snipers on a building.
Right. Michael Eric Dyson, this is the very issue that I talked earlier in the show about with Carol Anderson, professor from Emory University, and we talked about how risky and unfortunate, well, really, really risky it is now to have this conversation about black men in particular dying at the hands of police, which is an ongoing conversation, unfortunately, in this country, now tied in with the idea that, oh, hey, police officers get killed too. Those are both critically important issues, but having them at the same time seems to me a very risky and potentially unproductive conversation.
Yeah, it is. Because one, if it's reactionary, as opposed to visionary, it becomes a problem because, you know, even before this horrendous event in Dallas last night, the president, of course, was clear to make the point, look, you know, Black Lives Matter doesn't mean that blue lives don't matter, that police people deserve to go home at the end of the day. They do. But the conflation of those two means that what we do is set up ourselves to have a conversation that's a zero-sum game. The degree to which the gains are experienced by police are seen as taking away from the gains for African-American and Latino people, or the perception that the legitimate complaints of black and Latino people somehow comes at the expense of acknowledging the need for these police to be protected and to do their jobs. To conflate those two to begin with is the problem. American citizens who are unarmed in this society, or even if they have the right to bear arms, must be served and protected by a police force that doesn't target them. At the same time, police forces that are meant to uphold the law should uphold the law. And the burden is a greater burden on police people than American citizens. Why? Because they have a badge and a gun. They are the if you will, the representatives of the state. They are hired as such. And as a result of that, we must not tyrannize the citizenry in the name of protecting the legitimate sphere of influence that police must exercise themselves in. At the same time, as American citizens, of course, we are a law-abiding nation that must be subject to rules and restrictions in order for parity, in order for comity, in order for justice to prevail. But to have those conversations without understanding that the president should speak up boldly and articulately, political figures, mayors, police chiefs, and the like, should speak up boldly and articulately and not just, you know, have a sense of wound and complaint about the fact that police people are not being treated fairly. Of course we want to treat them fairly, but that must not be the response to black people who say, we just don't want to be killed every day by police people who don't seem to do this to other populations and other groups of people. It is a very dangerous conversation to have, but it's a necessary conversation to have if we are indeed courageous enough to embrace both the need and mandate for racial justice on the one hand and for the protection of our law-abiding citizens as well as those police people who are charged with protecting us.
The country is now facing an increasingly complex debate, one that it was already having. Certainly the deaths of black people, people of color, in confrontations with police. We've seen the events, of course, in Minnesota and in Baton Rouge, two of many events that have been documented. And, of course, the killings of police officers in Dallas last night and the wounding of seven others. Michael Eric Dyson, academic, best-selling author, professor of sociology at Georgetown. I appreciate you joining us here at the end of the show to help us put this in some very, very difficult context. Michael Eric Dyson, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, before we let you go today, let's return to what has been and what will be the main story today, and you imagine for many days to come. There is still a lot we don't know, but this is what we do know. Overnight, five police officers were shot dead by snipers at a protest in Dallas. Seven more officers were injured in the shooting, some critically. As we heard earlier in the hour, one suspect involved in the standoff told police that he wanted to kill white people, especially police officers. Three suspects are in custody and refusing to cooperate with police in Dallas. As elsewhere in the country, the protest in Dallas was sparked by the shootings of Philando Castile and Alton Sterling by police in Minnesota and in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, respectively. From our Facebook page, Ryan Larson says, I'm embarrassed and ashamed to live in the United States and be a citizen of the United States. Here's Dallas Mayor Mike Rollins.
I think that we have a tone in this country right now that our bellicose nature comes through our mouths, and we need to shut them, and we need to listen, and we need to understand what is going on.
That's Mike Rollins, the mayor of Dallas, speaking to CBS News earlier today, and the world continues to react to the violence that we have seen played out in the last 72 hours. Speaking in Poland, where President Obama is at the moment, NATO Secretary General Jan Stoltenberg has expressed his condolences to the families of those who lost their lives after snipers opened fire on police officers in the heart of Dallas. President Obama told reporters at the summit in Poland that the attack on law enforcement was vicious, it was calculated, and unjustified.
We will learn more, undoubtedly, about their twisted motivations. But let's be clear, there's no possible justification for these kinds of attacks or any violence against law enforcement.
We thank you for joining us in this difficult hour discussing America and our core values. We always want to hear from you at 8778MYTAKE. You can tweet us at The Takeaway and join this conversation today and every day. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. John Hockenberry is back on Monday. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.